Okay, great. Thank you once again. It's great to be here. My second introduction. Around 100 years ago, in 1919, there was an expedition, a famous expedition, that actually, this is not working. Good. There was an expedition to what used to be Portuguese territory. This was an expedition by Eddington, organized by Eddington, to the Príncipe Island and to Sobral in Brazil. And more or less, that's when general relativity as a field was born. This was 1919. And the news at the time were amazing. If you, I did the exercise to search for the New York Times at the time. The dates are here, okay? And the first article read something like, "The lights are always askew in the heavens. Men of science are more or less agog over the results of eclipse. Einstein's theory triumphs. Stars were not where they seem or were calculated to be, but you don't need to worry." And a week later, again on the New York Times, don't worry about the new theory. Physicists agree that it can be disregarded for all practical purposes. Newton's law is safe. And then, actually, I like this. If you go further below, other professors' view. Yeah, we really were important. Now, Newton's law was safe, and this is kind of funny, because at exactly the same time, actually a few years before, the first non-trivial exact solution to the field equations of general relativity in vacuum was discovered. It was a mathematical description. Was discovered, well, actually, it was nothing Newtonian. Okay, it was what we now know as a black hole solution, a vacuum black hole solution known as the Schwarzschild solution. So this was around 1916 or so. And decades later, we actually understood the most general vacuum solution. So again, absence of matter, that's asymptotically flat. This means it looks like stuff we might observe, okay? And that's nice. It's analytic, it's regular, everything behaves well. This is called the Kerr solution. It describes a black hole with spin. And I had to show you that I do something for a living. So I wrote down the mathematical equation for these guys, okay? It reads like this. I'm setting Newton's constant and the speed of light to one. So you don't see G's and C's here. All you see are A's. A's are basically the angular momentum of solution. It tells you how fast it's spinning. And the mass M, which is here, which really is the gravitational mass of the black hole, stuff that you measure far away from the gravitational attraction. Any of the trillion black holes in our universe is described by this geometry, by this line element, any. And this is really an extraordinary statement. If you think about what you need to describe this room alone, just think about the enormity of parameters to describe me. How tall I am, how many kilograms, how many hairs, and I have a lot. The color of my eyes, all of this goes into describing it. Black holes have two parameters. This is known as the uniqueness result of general relativity, or the no-hair theorem, more colloquially. And a former Nobel Prize, Chandrasekhar, said, you know, really, this is the most shattering experience I've ever seen. The realization that an exact solution of the field equations provides the absolutely exact representation of an untold number of black holes out there. It's incredible. It's incredible and so useful for somebody that wants to search for new physics. Now, let me give you a 1 minute introduction about black holes. I'm going to imagine that I'm living close to one of them, and I'm going to throw matter at this black hole, okay? If you're far away from the black hole, like this star over here or planet, then all you see is Newtonian dynamics. You're there happily going on circular, stable motion, okay? Like we see the Earth going around the sun. But if you go further in, relativistic effects become important, okay? And there's a point, if you get too close, there's no stable motion. This white region over here, okay, it's the region where no matter can be there in a stable way. It has to fall, it has to plunge onto the black hole. And there's a very special region, which we call the light ring, this ring over here, okay, where matter is unstable, it falls. But if you carefully fine-tune the trajectory of a photon, you take a laser beam like this one, you shoot it in appropriate way, this guy is going to hit me in the back of my head. Okay? So black holes admit the existence of closed photon orbits. That's what it means. And of course, if a photon can do this, then a gravitational wave can also do this. Actually, the light ring kind of controls the life of a black hole, the relaxation of a black hole, because it can trap waves close to it. So all the late time behavior of black holes, and I'm going to show you in a minute, is dictated by light ring. There's another interesting region, and if I have time, I'll try to describe you the physics that we think is associated with it. And it's called the Yerga region. It's there for any spinning black hole. Okay, so if you take a spinning black hole and you take a powerful spaceship, you turn the engines on and it can remain at rest with respect to you. You just, you know, fine tune the engines in the appropriate way. But if you get within the Yerga region, there is no spaceship in the universe that can remain at rest with respect to you or distant stars. It's dragged by the rotation of the black hole. And many years ago, Roger Penrose, the 2020 Nobel Prize in Physics, imagined a way to extract energy away from black holes using this fact. His idea was really simple. He assumes that there's some alien civilization out there. They found a black hole. Okay, here's the black hole. And now they build this simple device, a metal ring attached to some shafts, which are in turn attached to a magnet. Okay? Now you lower the ring onto the Yerga region. It has to spin with the black hole because it's inside the Yerga region. And then you see the shafts rotate, the magnet rotates, and then Faraday's induction law tells you, well, there's a current going on here, so this lamp has to shine. It's an easy way to extract energy away from black hole. And back then, Roger Penrose, in that same paper, only made the following statement. I think we should take black holes seriously, and their consequences should be explored in full detail. You know, who knows? And he was saying this because he knew that our laws of physics break down in black hole interiors. We don't have a description of what happens in the interior of a black hole. Gravity, as we know it, as it's described by general relativity, fails. It's as simple as that. Okay? Now, so how do we go around and study the failure of general relativity inside black holes? We need something. We need some sign. We need to talk to the geometry. And the way to talk to the geometry was provided to us by Einstein already in 1916. Okay? It's a very simple procedure that I think most of us in gravity do, and that's to do exactly what we do when we want to look at sound waves. I'm here in the room. My vocal cords are disturbing the average pressure, so I just expand the aerodynamic equations around some, you know, average pressure and density, right? That's exactly what we do if you want to look at gravitational waves. You take your Minkowski space and you disturb Minkowski space by adding some small fluctuations, H, okay? When you do this and you expand the field equations to first order, it's a simple procedure, okay? What you're going to find is that those fluctuations obey a wave equation with a characteristic speed, the speed of light. So that's easy. There should be something propagating tidal forces at the speed of light, okay? Very good. We just need to detect them. Now, the problem with detecting gravitational waves is that they're extremely weak. They're gravitational forces traveling at the speed of light. But any astrophysical object out there gives you something like this signal over here seen in the north of the US, okay? The black solid line, I hope you can see it in the back, is a typical gravitational wave emitted by a pair of black holes or stars, okay? You can see this very well, but as time goes by, the frequency is increasing because the system is losing energy. So it starts as a low frequency, it loses energy, it needs to inspiral, Okay. And the waves mimic what the binary is doing. So frequency goes up, amplitude goes up, and eventually these guys collide. This is called a chirp signal because that's roughly how some birds sing. And if you look at the level of noise in the detector, this red curve here or the blue curve over here, it's way above the signal that you want to measure. This was a problem for 4 decades. You just need to be very sophisticated. You have to have a good detector and you have to have a good way of extracting signals from noise, okay? Now, the best way there is, and you can show this, to extract signals from noise is to actually know what you're looking for, okay? It's called match filtering, and the idea is very simple. You have your binary, it's emitting a gravitational wave, okay? You have some detector somewhere, but there's intrinsic noise to the detector, so the output is some noisy stuff. It consists on the wave you're looking for, H, plus some noise, okay? So the idea is to filter the noise in a way that the output is as clean as possible, and you know there's something there, okay? Now, you can show that the optimal filter is called the Wiener filter, or matched filter. And it's optimal in the sense that the signal-to-noise ratio of your event is the largest possible. The matched filter, as I said, is exactly the signal you're looking for. Let me give you an example that I worked out before coming here, okay? Suppose you're looking for this guy, this signal over here, but you have a noisy detector. So actually what you're seeing is something like this. It looks like junk, okay? When you do match filtering, well, you cross-correlate the noisy output with the thing you're looking for. And then that's it, you see the output of the correlation as you slide the filter in time. And you get a peak somewhere here. It means, well, look, there seems to be something here. That's exactly what the LIGO-Virgo-Kagra collaboration do. That's a collaboration of gravitational wave detectors to search for this. And of course, when I tell this to any audience, to my mother, she asks me, hey, how do you know what you're looking for? I say, well, it's a pair of black holes. Yeah, but how big are they? Well, I don't know. Could be a 1 solar mass, could be a 10 solar mass black hole, and a 5 solar mass guy, or a 10 solar mass, or a 20. So actually what we do, because we lack imagination, is we just build a template with all possible combinations that sweep across perimeter space in a sufficiently fine way. So the LIGO-Virgo collaboration uses now roughly 500,000 filters to do the searches, okay? But that's basically the idea. You need to be very accurate in how you predict the signal, and you need to have sufficient computational power. And this paid off. This paid off in 2015. This is what we saw. A pair of black holes merging somewhere in the universe, millions of light years away. What you see here is extreme deflection of light by the background stars. Of course, this is not what we saw. This is the result of a simulation, okay? They were roughly 30 solar masses each, and our detector was ready for them, okay? LIGO and also Virgo, to some extent, saw this event. This is how it looks. Even though we're used to seeing planets and the sun and it all looks fantastic, okay? Because our brain is tuned to the light source. This image, our kids, the next generation, are going to look at this and say, oh, wow, that's a beautiful black hole binary merging and forming a single black hole. To us, this is all very weird. Our brain is not used to interpret this signal, okay? But all the physics is there, right? Frequency, this is as it was as the output of the detector, minimal filtering, okay? You see something whose frequency is increasing, the amplitude is increasing, and then it dies off. It's a beautiful signal. The first ever detection of gravitational wave. Now, I told you that we're lucky. For some reason, there's some magic in the field equations that any black hole is described by 2 parameters. But when you place them in binaries, a second magic occurs, okay? If you place the Earth with some companion, The companion is going to tidally distort the Earth. It does. That's why days are getting longer. That's why the moon is getting farther away from us. When you do this to black holes, their deformation is zero. Well, at least as measured by the change in the multipolar moments of your spacetime. It's a magic we don't fully understand. But there's another magic to these binaries. If you start them in an eccentric orbit, like the moon is doing to the Earth or the Earth around the sun, the emission of gravitational radiation quickly circularizes your system, okay? So give me two black holes in the universe, and most certainly they are going to be doing, at least when they're orbiting at high frequencies, they're going to be doing quasi-circular motion with very, very simple constituents. They're the ideal laboratory to test physics. They really are, okay? Good. Now, what can we learn? Yeah, sure, black holes are really interesting. Black holes are black. What exactly can we learn? Well, we can learn how many black holes are there, where exactly they are, how were they born? How do you get a black hole to be a billion solar masses? How do you grow a black hole to this big? When exactly in the history of the universe were black holes formed? And how? What collapsed to give these guys? Is it true? Is it true that the outcome of gravitational collapse is always a black hole? Are you always going to form a region from which not even light can escape? And if it does, is it also true that Einstein was right? Are these described by that strange Kerr geometry? Do they belong to that two-parameter family of things? And if they are so simple, if it's true that they're so simple, can we use them to test other things? Can we use them to test the environment they live in? Can we use them to probe the dark matter content of the universe or any other field in the universe? And how do we do this? Now, I don't have time to obviously go through all of this, but let me select a couple of things that we can do that we are doing, okay? The first is black hole spectroscopy. You look at the final state. So again, here's my process. A couple of black holes merging, okay? Again, it's important that when you look at this, you think that we have no idea of what's inside these guys. Our laws break down inside of black holes, okay? So you have two black holes. There you go. They're emitting gravitational waves, amplitude and frequency up. They collide, and they should be forming a single guy, which at late times just shuts off. So if you look backwards in time, okay, you're going to have a black hole that's slightly distorted, and then, well, it was two guys going off. So you can expand the field equations around a single distorted black hole in the same way that we generate sound, you remember? So we expand Einstein equations around the solution that describes a single black hole. This should tell me how a black hole relaxes, okay? So when you do that, it turns out that all of the physics is contained in this partial differential equation. A linear, of course, that looks like Schrodinger's equation with some effective potential, D, okay? And the source term describes describes whoever is disturbing a black hole. So if I'm there waving my hand, that's my hand periodically moving, okay? So you can Fourier transform this to look at the spectrum, the characteristic frequencies of this system, okay? And you end up with the usual thing, the resolvent of this guy, and you solve by imposing the appropriate physical boundary condition. If you do this in quantum mechanics, at least the usual version of that, or in the string attached at both ends, then you're going to find that the system is conservative and that it's complete. The system of your solution of eigenfrequencies and eigenmodes is complete, okay? Of course, when you do this for a black hole, something different happens because you're actually looking at a dissipative system. Waves are being lost to infinity and are going down the drain, down the horizon of a black hole, okay? So actually the solution to these characteristic frequencies omega lies in the complex frequency plane, okay? There's a real part that tells you how this stuff rings, and an imaginary part, which I'm calling 1/tau, that tells you the lifetime of your fluctuation, of the black hole. Okay, we know these numbers to 20 decimal places. Okay, calculated within linearized theory. For example, for a 10 solar mass black hole, I'm sure you cannot see these numbers, at least if you're me. But for a 10 solar mass black hole, we're talking about a 1 kilohertz oscillation, okay, and the relaxation time of 0.5 milliseconds. So if you take Budapest, a black hole the size of Budapest, it relaxes on a scale of 0.5 milliseconds. It's amazing. You know, somebody's kicking Budapest, and on half a millisecond, it quieted down. It's really amazing, though. No? Of course, it's amazing because it's relaxing at the speed of light, okay? It's not at the speed of traffic or an earthquake. It's the speed of light. So we know these numbers. We can do spectroscopy. But it's good to bear in mind that that analysis is totally linear, okay? And there's limitation, even in linear theory. First of all, there's the nonlinear components that I'm brushing aside. But even within linear theory, you might ask, well, is it true that I can always expand my signal in a series of damped sinusoids? And it's not. If you try to invert the Green's function of that problem back to the time domain, yes, there is a piece that's an exponentially damped sinusoid, but you're also going to find two other components. One of them is a prompt emission. So let me do physics. I take a star going around its business close to a black hole, this star over here, okay? It's emitting gravitational waves. A piece of that signal is going directly to the detector. I'm calling this piece prompt. You can identify this in the Green's function, okay? Another piece tries to escape to infinity, but it's backscattered by the space-time curvature. We call these power law tails. And there's another piece, gravitons, that were emitted towards the black hole, but the deflection that they suffer is so large that they orbit the black hole once or twice or 10 times or 100 times and then go to your observer. This is the ring down. This is the ring down component. But at any time, you should be seeing all of these data. Okay? Good. So this is what LIGO did, the first black hole spectroscopy test of general relativity is here, okay? So you have a detection, we saw waves. What you do is the following. You find the best fit numerical simulation that fits your data, okay? And that allows you to predict the final black hole, the mass and the angular momentum of the final black hole. When you know this, well, you go to my tables and you extract relaxation times and frequency. These are the black solid line here, the 90% posterior distribution. Okay, but you have the signal, so you can just fit the relaxation stage to an exponentially damped sinusoid, okay? To a single one. If you do that exercise, the first thing that you or your student is going to face is, well, when exactly should I start fitting? You know, when is this stage starting? So it depends on the initial time, and the results for different times are here. If you start 1 millisecond after the peak of your waveform, you get the green line, and at late times, you get slightly different things. Of course, we're doing linearized theory, so this should improve as you go later in time. You pay a price, the signal-to-noise ratio becomes smaller, just the signal is weaker, but that's the price we have to pay, okay? And you see that at late times, both predictions are comfortably in agreement. It doesn't look magnificent. The error of this stuff is huge. So it's hard to impress any audience, except that this is the first test of something that was orbiting really, really close to the horizon of a black hole. It was orbiting at the light ring of a black hole. We've never seen this before, okay? Now, this was the first event. This is how it's going to look 10 years from now. The first event had a signal-to-noise ratio of around 7, okay? In the next 10 years, we're going to see stuff with signal-to-noise ratios of 40. With a signal-to-noise ratio of 40, that's how that line looks. You barely see it, okay? It's the same thing, relaxation time frequency, And these are the lines. In fact, with this signal-to-noise ratio, you're going to see two modes. This is the quadrupolar mode, and this is the octupolar mode. Now you see, with one mode, relaxation time frequency, you measure, you estimate mass and spin. With two modes, you test the theory. They need to be consistent, okay? This signal-to-noise ratio of 40, in 2034, Europe is sending a space-based mission, LISA, that's going to have signal-to-noise ratios of thousands. I can't even plot that, okay? Now, in most, if I go to an astrophysics community, they're going to ask me, well, yeah, that's all very fine, but that's all vacuum. How can I trust any of this? You know, the wave is propagating through a curved universe. It sees all forms of matter. Sometimes there are stars. There's dust everywhere. How can I trust any of that? You can trust everything because gravitational waves couple. They don't couple to all purposes, to any of the matter between us and the source. There's no attenuation. There's no dissipation. There's just lensing, and we understand lensing, gravitational lensing, very well. So we do not need to worry about that. In fact, if you want to think about that, you can even use black holes as probes of the environment where these guys are living, where they're evolving. How can you do this? Well, the idea is very simple. We understand the components, two parameters alone, okay? They're driven by gravitational wave emission, so they're losing energy. They need to speed the spiral faster. If they are in a non-trivial environment, two things are going to occur. First, they accrete matter. They start eating the matter around it, okay? Second, they are going to be dragged by the environmental matter. They suffer dynamical friction, okay? And both of these effects actually drive the spiral faster. This means that if you're able to monitor the phase of your signal very precisely, you can understand the density of your environment, okay? This is one example of the things that you can do, okay? These are constraints that you can impose on the environmental density from the observation of the merger of two black holes. Here is what the current detectors can do. Y-axis is density in units of density of water. Don't ask me why I chose water. It's a random normalization, okay? Well, the first event, for example, tells you I can constrain the environmental density to be smaller than roughly 1,000 times that of water. Not really impressive. Nobody expects 1,000 times the density of water out there, anywhere in the universe, okay? But if you go to future detectors, look at this guy. This is LISA, the space-based mission. It's going to be constraining things, densities, to be smaller than 10 to the minus 12. You're now doing accretion disk physics, and the SIGO, future versions at least, will go down to dark matter distribution. So we'll be doing particle physics with gravitational wave detectors, okay? Now, you need to have some environmental density. You need the matter to be there for these kind of tests. We're talking about precision physics, okay? But let me end with something that's not a precision physics. You do not need any environmental distribution of matter. I'm going to tell you how you can constrain a certain type of matter, which we call ultralight fields. These are fields like the photon, electromagnetic waves, but which have a small mass, okay? They're slightly massive. And these have been outstanding candidates, like the axion, for dark matter, for either the totality or a component of dark matter. I'm not going to details, but one of them is written down here, and most of you may have seen it. It's the axion. It's involved to solve the strong CP problem, and generalizations of it are being used as dark matter components, okay? Now, I can test these guys even if their environmental density is zero, okay? And the idea is very simple. The idea is based on the extraction of energy by Penrose. You remember that if you if you are in the ergo region, there's no way but to co-rotate with the black hole. So the idea is very simple. You throw a low frequency wave onto a spinning black hole, and what you're going to get is something that's amplified, something that's stronger than the pulse you sent in. Okay? This is called super radiance, but some of you might know this as tidal acceleration, because it's very similar to what happens in the Earth-Moon system, actually. Yeah, how much time do I have? Do I have 5 minutes, 2 minutes? How much time do I have? Okay, good. So if you look at this system, the moon is going around the Earth very slowly. It takes a month, okay? But the Earth spins around its axis once a day, so it's spinning very fast. This is the model of tides, by the way, from the Son of Darwin. Now, the idea is you replace the surface of the Earth by something solid, the crust, spinning under the oceans. That's what's here in this figure, okay? Under normal circumstances, the tide at the moon rises would be aligned with the Earth-Moon axis. But because there's dissipation, there's friction, there's a small tidal angle, which I call phi, it doesn't really matter. There's some angle. There's some dissipation. And the dissipation means two things. First, that the day on Earth is getting longer. This has been measured, by the way. And to conserve angular momentum, something has to happen, right? The Earth cannot just spin slower. The moon is getting farther away from us. Okay, this has also been measured by lunar laser ranging. It's getting farther away from us at the pace of the growth of my fingernails. Okay, it's small, but it's visible. Okay, and so what happens actually is that you're transferring energy from the rotation of the Earth towards the moon. So super radiance is exactly the same. You take a light field, okay, any light field with any amplitude, and because of this process, a part of the tail of this field is within the ergo region. It's tapping onto the ergo region, and it's extracting energy away from spinning black holes. What you're going to get is a condensate outside of your spinning black hole that looks something like this, a dipolar distribution. And this happens for massive scalars, massive vectors, massive tensors, anything. Okay? The important thing about this process is the time scale. It's here. For a 1 million solar mass black hole, like the one we have at the center of the galaxy, the time scale for this process to occur can be of order of seconds. It's ridiculous. On seconds, you extract all the kinetic energy of a black hole if a massive field exists. Okay? Now, how can we use this? Just 1 minute. How can we use this? Well, in two different ways. Because the condensate is non-spherically symmetric, it's emitting gravitational waves. I have detectors, I can go and look for this, okay? These are bounds that, for example, LIGO or LISA can place on this field. I'm going to be doing particle physics with black holes. I can rule out fields with masses between 10 to the minus 9 and 10 to the minus 20 electron volt. We're talking about 10 orders of magnitude in field mass, okay? You can do this with gravitational wave detectors, but you can also do this with telescopes. Because if the field exists, I should not be seeing black holes spinning in certain mass ranges. And this is the game. You place your observations, these red crosses over here, okay? And you draw your instability line. This, on this window, black holes are unstable on timescales smaller than 10,000 years. I should not see them. They should not be there. Okay, so this constrains your field mass. In fact, the constraint on graviton masses is now on the particle physics group, which is a big source of pride for me. We're doing particle physics with black hole physics. It's amazing. So I'll finish here to tell you that this is the future. Gravitational wave astronomy will become a precision discipline. We do not understand gravity. Something will happen. When you start digging deep in the gravitational potential of black holes. Okay, this is a certainty. Our theory breaks down. We need to be sophisticated enough to understand how to study the near horizon region of black holes, but we will get there. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And it was good to hear that the future even brighter and even more exciting than this one. So I think because the time is running and we have a strong constraint on the lunch, I apologize. We need to go further. You can catch in the lunch break with Torio. And just 1 second, I would like to give you a little present as usual.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes, you have also the, this is our famous.
Oh, fantastic. Mercury. Fantastic. Thank you.
Don't use it in the shop because they will take it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.